Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On a Friday jobs day, well, there's jobs, first of all. There is dying companies, and there's how much Twitter ought to be paying you. But you got to stick around for that one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 8th of November. And the A-list economic news of the day today came to us from the Department of Labor this morning. The October jobs report, 204,000 people found work last month, way more than pretty much anybody had expected. The unemployment rate nudged up a hair to 7.3%. Yeah, it was mixed. Some good news, some bad. Oh, and one other thing, too. Right smack in the middle of the month that these data points are for, there was basically nobody home at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So what good are these numbers? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman got that assignment.
The theme to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which for today could be rethemed Good, Bad, and Confusing. Or as these economists put it,
distorted, noisy,
difficult,
misleading.
The data's mushy, you could call it that. That's a real good technical term.
That's Nariman Baravesh at IHS, and he says there is a technical term.
The noise-to-signal ratio of the recent data is fairly high. There's a lot of volatility in the data, special factors that you have to kind of sort through.
Let's start with the fact that there are two different surveys, the household survey, where they ask Americans if they've been working, and the establishment survey, where they ask businesses and government offices how many people are on the payroll. Only in October, hundreds of thousands of government workers were on furlough, says economist Justin Wolfers of the Brookings Institution.
In the survey of firm payrolls, you'll be counted as employed. And in the household survey, they call temporary layoff a form of unemployment. So the same person is either employed or unemployed, depending on which survey you look at.
Also, they did the survey 1 week late. That might have confused people. Tom Nardone at the Bureau of Labor Statistics says actually every month has statistical anomalies and a normal margin of error of 100,000 jobs or more.
The numbers this month are as reliable as they are most months, which may sound like a surprising statement.
Justin Wolfers says unless you're an economist or on the Federal Reserve, you might as well wait till next month when some of the data distortion and mushiness has diminished to figure out how the job market's doing. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It being a jobs report day, that is where we're going to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. For that, we've got Catherine Rempel of the New York Times and Felix Salmon from Reuters. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Salmon. Felix, do me a favor and step back from what Mitchell was just saying and give me your gut on this data. And you called the report this morning in your blog. You said it was garbage in, garbage out. But give me your gut on a trend here, would you?
Trend is good. We've had a series of pretty solid jobs reports. And if it carries on like this, and especially if we can start getting some of those long-term unemployed and the people who've dropped out of the workforce back into the workforce, then maybe at the beginning of next year, the Federal Reserve might take its foot off the accelerator a little bit. But I don't think that's going to happen in December.
Well, that accelerator thing, Catherine, of course, being the taper. So first of all, give me your gut on the numbers and then when you expect the Federal Reserve to react, if at all, in light of the economic labor picture.
Well, they're going to have to react sometime.
No, we can go on like this forever.
The balance sheet is just going to get infinitely bigger?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Once you've got $2 trillion, you can go to $3 trillion.
I think if you talk with some more conservative economists like John Taylor, the concern is that maybe they never will be able to taper because there will always be some reason to not do so. There will always be some concern about the economy. My gut reaction on the report, yes, better than expectations. There were upward revisions to the previous months. So this was a pretty good-looking report considering how low expectations were in particular.
Well, yeah. So, Felix, pick up on that point. And this is a vaguely political question, but I'm going to run it by you anyway. Given that the economy as personified by the labor report this morning escaped virtually unscathed from the shutdown and the debt limit debate to virtually everybody's eyes. What threat does Congress have now come January and February when the next time we have this debate comes up?
Right. So the last debate was made much worse by the fact that the stock market didn't panic.
Right.
If we'd had a big market plunge, then it would have helped concentrate minds a bit. The next one is going to be even tougher because not only will there not be a big market plunge, but everyone is going to say, and hey, look, it didn't have any effect on the economy either. And so we're going to be that much closer to Armageddon yet again.
Catherine, you buy that?
My sense is that Congress doesn't seem to care all that much whether people are freaking out or not. You know, the last few times that there have been these major showdowns, even when there was apparent concern from the markets or from consumer confidence, it look, I'm in New York, so I don't know. But from afar, it certainly seemed like...
Closer than Felix and I are.
Yeah, it certainly seemed like legislators weren't all that concerned. But basically, unless Armageddon happens, there's enough disbelief about its existence that they don't seem to care all that much whether markets are freaking out a little bit, as long as they're not freaking out entirely.
All right. I should clarify and say that Felix is just down the road. He's down in the OC, the Orange County, down in Orange County today.
Very sunny.
Yeah, it always is down there, man. All right, one last thing before I let you go, guys. On the Twitter IPO, crazy booming numbers yesterday. It faded a bit today. Felix, weigh in for me briefly on this idea that Twitter left money on the table by pricing itself too low.
It raised $2 billion, which is a lot of money. This was a cash-raising exercise, and it paid through the nose for that $2 billion. For the amount of stock that it sold, it could have raised $3-3.5 billion. And that works out to over $500,000 per employee. If they just priced this thing correctly, they could have given every employee a $500,000 bonus this year.
Catherine, did they blow it?
They still have more stock they can sell. You know, yeah. I think that had they priced more aggressively, actually, investors might have been more skeptical, and you could have had an event like we saw with Facebook,
right,
where the IPO price was way too high. So I think you can actually kind of argue it either way.
Fair enough. Catherine Rampell at the New York Times and Felix Salmon at Reuters. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we'll see you. Have a good weekend. All those big losses in the markets yesterday, by the way, traders got them all back today and then some. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Obama administration issued something called a final rule today. It requires virtually all insurance companies to offer coverage for mental health conditions, just as they would for physical problems, so that in theory, there would be no difference between how your insurance company pays for treatment of depression or a broken arm. The technical term is parity, and it brings with it some economic side effects. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
The rule is pretty clear. Everything, co-payments, deductibles, has to be the same for mental or physical care. So you'd think Walter Teague would want to celebrate. He's been a therapist in private practice for 32 years, and he's had lots of run-ins with insurance companies.
Therapists have been burned.
Teague says therapists like him who run their own practices have spent lots of time filing claims and appealing denials. Some have stopped accepting insurance. They want to see if the new rule on parity will be enforced.
They're going to hold back and wait and see how it develops.
That might be wise, because there's no guarantee that waves of insured new patients will suddenly materialize. Dr. Alexander Blunt teaches psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. He also has a practice. He says there's still a stigma against mental health care.
It's very hard to get around the implication that somehow getting help for something like depression indicates weakness.
But Dr. Blunt says patients will do therapy if it's part of a visit to a doctor's office. If a therapist on staff automatically checks in with, say, a diabetes patient to ask about depression. Now, the new parity rule could be a boon for counselors who work in rehab clinics for alcoholism or drug addiction. David Statton is president-elect of the American Rehabilitation Counseling Association, and he has a private counseling practice. He says his industry will see a landslide of new patients, and he wonders if it's prepared.
They've been talking about this for years, but, you know, now that it's actually happened, we're going to have to act pretty fast.
He already has three therapists on staff and will hire more. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As long as we're on health care, there are two sides to the ill-fated rollout of the Affordable Care Act. The big one, the one we've all been talking about, is the front end, the website. The bigger one, quite possibly, is the back end, the plumbing of actually making sure that people and their policies get matched up at insurance companies and at doctors' offices. Robert Leshevsky is the president of Health Policy Strategy and Associates. That's a healthcare consulting firm in Washington. Mr. Leshevsky, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I wonder what happens once this website gets fixed. Is everything miraculously done then?
Here's what I'm worried about. There are two parts to this website. It's really not the website. It's the whole computer system for the Obamacare rollout. And there are two parts to it. There's sort of the front door, which is the portal that people sign up through. That's what consumers are seeing. That's what the public is seeing.
This is healthcare.gov, right?
That's right.
Yep.
And then there's the back door, which really isn't healthcare.gov. It's the rest of the computer systems. It's what happens when someone signs up. The federal government has to send that enrollment to the insurance companies, so they're obviously enrolled, who they are, which plan they took, how much premium the feds are paying, how much premium they're paying, all the essential personal information. That part is having just as much trouble as the front end is. It's riddled with errors. Errors can range from 10% of the people to 50% of the people.
Is it possible that I could think that I have successfully enrolled in healthcare.gov, get to my doctor's office, and have them say, I'm sorry, who are you?
Yes, that's very possible. I had one insurance company CEO on the exchanges say to me recently, I just hope I know of all the people who think they've signed up for my plan. I don't want to scare people here.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to understand that so few enrollments are coming through now that the insurance companies are pretty much able to clean it up and straighten it out. It can take a few days to do. But sort of the good news, bad news. Bad news is only a few enrollments are coming through to each insurance company a day, 10, 15, 20 enrollments. The good news is that's so few that they can actually spend the time cleaning them up and getting them right.
Yeah.
The risk here is if the government opens up the front door before the back door is fixed, and now thousands of enrollments start coming in every day, some significant percentage are bad, they're not going to be able to handle it.
It does sort of sound like you're saying if you think healthcare.gov is messed up now, wait till it gets fixed.
If the front end gets fixed and the back end doesn't fix, oh my goodness, it's going to be terrible. But the Obama administration, I think, understands this very well. The people that are working to fix it understand it. I can't believe they would open the front door without the back door being fixed.
But then again, you'd have thought that they'd have had this thing figured out before they opened it up, right?
There we are.
Yeah. What if I am Dr. Smith, a general practitioner in Des Moines, Iowa? What am I seeing out of this whole mess?
Well, what you're hopefully going to see are more people coming into your doctor's office. The doctor's going to see more people coming in with insurance cards, whether they're Medicaid cards or private insurance cards, and they're going to get their health care paid for in a rational way, as opposed to being on reimbursed care and not being able to afford to pay. What the doctor's going to worry about in this whole administrative mess is whether or not his records are right, because he doesn't want to turn people down. If somebody comes in and thinks they're covered and he hasn't got them on the records, he's probably going to want to collect in advance.
One more question before I let you go, Mr. Leshevsky. It's a little bit sideways, but the president yesterday apologized to Chuck Todd of NBC News. He said he's sorry. He said he is going to start looking at ways to make it better for people. One of the things that has apparently been floated is increasing some of the subsidies that people get to cover the costs of the Affordable Care Act. Is it possible to do that without reopening the whole law and thus the can of worms?
Well, I didn't think he could waive the employer mandate without doing it legislatively. So I don't know what they have in mind from a regulatory standpoint. But increasing the subsidies is spending more money. And the Congress controls the purse strings. So I don't know how they can do that.
Robert Leshevsky is the president of Health Policy and Strategy Associates. It's a healthcare consulting firm in Washington, D.C. Mr. Leshevsky, thanks very much for your time, sir. Coming up.
And so if we know it's your birthday, it's just a nice thing if a flight attendant says, oh, you know, happy birthday. Thanks for flying with us.
Or it's scary and weird. Airlines and big data straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. That surprising, albeit rough around the edges, jobs report sent Wall Street bulls off and running today. The Dow Industrials rumbled up 167 points, a full percent, closed at 15,761, did the blue chips. The Nasdaq charged ahead 61 points, more than a percent and a half, 39.19. The S&P 500 up 23 points, 1.3%, closed at 1770. For the week that was, the Dow was up 0.9%. The S&P 500 ended 0.5% higher. The NASDAQ was the only loser this week, down 0.1%. On the second day, Twitter euphoria receded and shares closed down 3.25 points. That's about 7% for that stock. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
How did mortgages get us into so much trouble, and what exactly is insider trading? Marketplace senior producer Patty Hirsch explains the news of the day with a dry erase pen in our whiteboard video series. Tune in at marketplace.org/whiteboard or find us on YouTube.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Events take place at Arlington National Cemetery and around the country in observance of Veterans Day. Bond markets are closed, but stock markets are open. And on November 11th, 1965, the band that had become the Velvet Underground played its first gig, a high school dance in Summit, New Jersey. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Secretary of State John Kerry spent his day in Geneva, Switzerland today, meeting with his Iranian counterpart and others to talk about Iran's nuclear program. If there is a deal in which Tehran makes the right kinds of concessions, some of the economic sanctions on Iran might be lifted in return. Those are sanctions that go back for decades and have grown more complicated over the years. And so Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains rolling them back is not going to be easy.
To get a sense of just how thorny this all is, imagine you're a tourist in Iran. John Paul Tennant is CEO of travel company GeoX, which sends Americans there.
Tell our clients, just carry cash. In Iran, it's the exception, not the rule, that you'll be able to use any kind of credit card, so people just carry cash.
He's just back from 2 weeks in Iran. For purchases too large for cash, say a fine Persian carpet, it's a tortuous journey.
They can accept a credit card, but it gets processed in Dubai. The rug gets shipped from Dubai.
That's just one small example of just how tough sanctions are. And that's just banking, to say nothing of rules about oil trading and frozen assets abroad.
They're just voluminous.
Trade attorney David Levine.
To parse through every particular restriction or prohibition itself is very complicated, and so removing those piece by piece, I think, raises some complexities.
Levine works on these kinds of issues as a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery. Not everything would be hard, though.
It is relatively easy for the United States to unfreeze a negotiated amount of Iranian financial assets that are presently frozen.
Richard Sawoya is director of USA Engage, a business group that generally opposes trade sanctions. Other sanctions will be trickier, especially since they won't be lifted across the board. Hossein Askari is an Iranian-born international business professor at George Washington University.
If you do it partially, I think that's going to be difficult.
Saying Iran can sell all the oil it wants is easy, but that's not likely. More likely are complex rules of how much it can sell and to whom. Askari adds that it's tough to remove sanctions, but tougher to put them back in place. That involves banks, companies, and governments. So negotiators better be sure Iran will hold up its part of the deal. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Monday is Veterans Day, and for the 21.9 million Americans who've served, the Veterans Day holiday sometimes comes with perks. Everything from all-you-can-eat pancakes and half-price oil changes to free financial advice. But where is the line between recognizing military service and boosting profit margins? Shannon Mullen takes a look.
Most holidays give businesses another excuse to target all consumers, but not Veterans Day.
People put their lives on the line typically and then earn the right to really celebrate.
David Berkowitz is with the marketing firm MRY. He says the holiday does give the rest of us a chance to recognize veterans, but there are no hard rules for businesses.
It's not like, okay, well, 10% off is enough, but 20%, that's great. I mean, what is something that is a bit above and beyond what, say, someone will find in a typical, you know, circular or that veterans will be especially excited about?
The website military.com lists dozens of discounts this year for veterans and their families. Everything from free admission to national parks to a free meal at Hooters. Kelly Martin teaches marketing ethics at Colorado State University. She says all consumers are watching, and it's hard to tell which companies are trying to recognize veterans and which ones just want their money.
A lot of it comes down to how it makes them feel, right? If it doesn't feel authentic, then my guess is that it's probably not.
Pandering or not, many veterans are grateful for the discounts, says Joe Davis, spokesman for the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
Military folks, they're not driving up into these restaurants in Mercedes and the most fanciest cars out there. And for the most part, a lot of them are just living paycheck to paycheck. So any discount that any commercial business can provide them is a good discount.
And Davis says anytime Americans thank our veterans, that's a good thing. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
A quick update before we go on. We told you the other day about the Army shutting down ROTC units at 13 universities, mostly in the South. Yeah, the Army has changed its mind on that one. What do you think? Pizza and a movie tonight? Swing by the video store to pick up a rental? All right, maybe not in 15 years have you actually gone to the store in person to rent a movie. And in point of fact, your days of going to a Blockbuster are numbered. Blockbuster's parent company said this week it's going to shut down its last remaining retail locations of that chain. So we asked Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary to find out why companies like that hang on for so long when it's clear the economics just aren't working out.
Say a final goodbye to the Dropbox. Goodbye to that bag of movies you'd fight over on the couch.
Red Riding Hood, Night and Day, It's Complicated, the Hereafter.
And goodbye to your old membership card.
Yeah, the blue and yellow card, right.
Blockbuster is closing its DVD by mail business and its last 300 retail stores, like this one in New Jersey. Where I caught up with Mike Gottlieb, he was the one wistful about his card, and Don Fletcher, he was watching It's Complicated. Blockbuster will join a long list of businesses that tried to hang on in the digital age, but nope. It'll be in the company of Circuit City and Borders Books. Not a surprise to Mike Gottlieb.
Not at all. I'm never surprised when brick-and-mortar stores go out of business these days because there's so many alternatives on the internet.
So many that the number of people watching DVDs on any given weeknight dropped by a third in just 4 years. And Blockbuster was in bankruptcy back in 2010, so this was not a movie with a surprise ending. Why does it take so long for a wounded company to die?
You know, when you close a store, it costs money.
That's David Strasser from Janney Capital Markets. Even a limping company brings in some money. Enough that shutting it down is sometimes too costly.
Getting things out of the store, marking down inventory, doing all of the things, you know, to just leave that store flat. Status quo sometimes can just last a long time.
That's why companies hang on. Blockbuster has. Linens and Things did. But in the end, all of those things have become available on the internet. Which is bad news, says analyst Michael Pachter, if you're a store known best for selling one thing.
There's really no reason for specialty retail unless they offer something you can't get elsewhere.
And if you don't offer that, get ready for the credits to roll. I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
To paraphrase Scott McNeely at Sun Microsystems, we live in the age of big data. Get used to it. Everybody and their sister is tracking everything we do and using it most of the time to sell us things. Airlines collect tons of data on us, where we go, what we buy on board, where we like to sit. But they've been really slow in putting that data to work to, yes, sell us stuff. So when we read in the Wall Street Journal today that airlines might start using all of that data, well, it gave us a start, because being stuck on a plane for 5 hours is bad enough, but when somebody wants to sell you things and there's no place to hide, Marketplace's Queena Kim gives us a view of the future from 30,000 feet.
Richard Gritta is an aviation expert at the University of Portland, and he says airlines need to find new ways to make money off us.
They're starting to tap out the obvious things like charging for meals.
And luggage and early check-in. Gritta says the other day he heard a guy complaining that airlines are going to remove one of the bathrooms to fit in more seats, to which he quipped,
"Hey, how about taking out all the Johns and just selling Depends?" You know?
The airlines might just have the data to do that. They've already got a lot of info on us, and they're poised to start collecting even more. Harriet Vasquez runs the blog Stuck at the Airport.
It was just announced that people can use their electronic devices the entire flight, and airlines that have Wi-Fi will make very good use of that.
Let's say Vasquez surfs the web while on a flight to Chicago. The airline knows she lives in Seattle, so she might get an ad for
a rental car. I might need a taxi, a reservation at a restaurant.
And she says we might see more product hawking in the aisles. Take the duty-free cart, which usually whizzes by.
They might know that this man has bought gifts on the way home before and to linger a little longer there.
Brett Snyder runs the blog Cranky Flyer, and he says we shouldn't be too cynical. He says flyers have been complaining they feel like cattle, and a little data mining could change that.
And so if we know it's your birthday, it's just a nice thing if a flight attendant says, oh, you know, happy birthday, thanks for flying with us.
But a better birthday present would be a little more legroom. In San Francisco, I'm Queen Akim for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, day in which, by my calculations, Twitter owes me $5,940 American money. All right, they're not so much my calculations as they are the calculations of some clever people at Time Magazine. They built a widget that factors in the number of followers somebody has, how many times a day that person tweets, compounds it by some corporate valuation numbers that Twitter put in its IPO prospectus, and voila, almost $6,000 the company owes me. Yeah, here's hoping on that one. We've got a link to the fine print at marketplace.org. And that is, by the way, Marketplace, the radio show from APM. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.